Aloha, this is Nako with Medicine for the People. You're listening to KEP Dub FM LP 97.3 right here on the channel, the lifeline, straight to the home, wherever you are. We are listening, we are shouting out. All nature responds. Aloha.
Show is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ SSD, here on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. All right, don't panic, but I'm going to play you a lecture by Nathaniel Brandon from, it was about 2006 in Los Angeles at Borders Books. Or Barnes & Noble, or one of those at a book signing. For those of you who don't know, Nathaniel Brandon, Ayn Rand, was a cougar, believe it or not. Say what you want about Ayn Rand, she was a cougar. She had this boyfriend. Nathaniel Brandon was dating a 20-year-old man when she was in her 40s. So he then had a falling out with her, and did his own career as a psychologist and started the self-esteem movement. So, yeah, he has some criticism of her, but he still adheres to his objectivist stuff and is still, you can still tell he's a, you know, conservative capitalist. So I'm going to critique Ayn Rand. I was into Ayn Rand when I was like 14. And know quite a bit about her, so I'm gonna explain what is wrong with Ayn Rand. And after that, the other thing that's happened is I just found on YouTube King Crimson. When Adrian Blue left King Crimson, I kind of got out of them, and I should have stayed involved, stayed up on what they were doing, because now they've released, they've been touring into when bands were allowed to tour. Before the deforestation virus, they were so in 2017. What he's done now is he's gotten back together with Mel Collins, and he has Tony Levin as the bass player and a couple other. You know, they're always initiating, and Pat Mastelito. They're always bringing in new musicians in King Crimson. What he's done is he's gone back to the first three albums, and has done some incredible stuff with those. And he does, you know, a little bit about, I'll tell you a little bit about Discipline Global Mobile, is there's a way to support musicians without supporting the corporate record companies. So yeah, what else? So yeah, don't forget to check out To the Moon and Back. She's on at 2 p.m. Dr. Zoom is on Sundays at 5, and we have this 1:30 newscast that we've really put a lot of work into the newscast and bringing you the community calendar and what's going on. It's news you can use. It's empowerment news, and that's every day at 1:30. Colors of Error is at 9 p.m. And a disclaimer. The disclaimer, I don't do it every week, but the opinions on this show, it's mostly going to be today my opinion. My opinion, so please use your own brain at all times when listening to Talk is Cheap. And yeah, do your own research, and the opinions are not those of Eugene Peaceworks or the producers or anyone here at KEPW. So listen at your own risk. All right, so coming up, Nathaniel Brandon, I'm going to do it in two parts. And I'll do, I'll add and subtract to what I did do this week, next week, on my commentary. And again, and I'll play you some stuff from Discipline Global Mobile and some incredible latest King Crimson, where they've redone stuff, and it's actually kind of poignant to today's, to what's going on in today's world. So thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon. Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Also streaming online at kpw.org. Okay, so like I say, Nathaniel Brandon coming up here, and let me give you my commentary on Ayn Rand, the problems with Ayn Rand, and because she's very influential, one of the and you'll hear Nathaniel Brandon talk about this stuff, and you'll hear me ask him about what she would think of today's corporations. And what I got into her for was because of individuality. And there is a lot to be said for individuality. And he went on, took that, further with his psychology, Nathaniel Brandon. And he talks about, and self-esteem and, insecurity. There are certain principles of psychology, of basic psychology, that are true. Most of it goes off the rails. And I'm not sure about psychiatry. And, there's a group here in Eugene whose name escapes me. I should have written that down. Mind Freedom, who will tell you about the pitfalls of psychiatry. So, but anyway, basic psychology. I've found that most people, it's your insecurity. You can trace things back to your insecurity. So, the individuality was something that I got into Ayn Rand for. But then, what she said about the robber barons. You'll hear what he has to say about him and what a hack he is. They're both bits of a hack. And in his case, he was kind of an opportunist, and his career was basically made because of his relationship with Ayn Rand. So there's a book called by Gustavus Myers about it's called The History of the Great American Fortunes. And basically most of the American fortunes that she's talking about, they were started by war profiteers. And there's a book called Good to Great recently, a few years ago, came out, too. And if you read that, in my opinion, in Good to Great, most of the people in that are also war profiteers. They cite Wells Fargo, who's a huge defense contractor supporter. So, and really, what makes invention, and this was her thing, was that people needed freedom to invent things. And she grew up in Stalinist Russia. So let me get into that in a few minutes. But the point she made was the robber barons, they needed freedom, and that's how they were able to invent stuff, and that's what made America the greatest country in the world. Well, first of all, like I say, all these got started their fortune. They had an unfair advantage because they were war profiteers. And, up until Joseph Kennedy, too, was a major war profiteer. Edison and... It was the tail end of the Enlightenment period, and this any high school history class will teach you this. I hope they still teach this anyway. That the Enlightenment, what it was first of all, the less secular society you have, the less religion you have. When you have freedom from religion, not necessarily against religion, although I am against organized religion, but not cutting you down for. But when you have freedom from religion. That is when you see a period of invention, when you have freedom from war economy. And even Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman and William F. Buckley, the true conservatives, are all against war. But when you have a period of less war, that's when you see much more invention. And this is throughout history. You can find this. And again, this is you can research this yourself. Please research this yourself. And again, and also when there's a more even distribution of wealth is when you see more invention. And when you have a middle class, or, you know, if everyone was middle class, we would have a classless society. And when you have more more leisure time, because you have less more even distribution of wealth, that's when you see more invention. And my own observation, this is an example of my own, that and I'm not defending the Industrial Revolution of the North, but during the Civil War, the South was started by French aristocrats. And the distribution of the South was, you had a slave class, and then you had these ultra wealthy people, and you didn't see much invention come out of there. Whereas up in the North, even though the factory system, I'm not defending the factory system. In fact, I've been to the old factories there that they've changed into malls in Massachusetts, and the satanic mills of the North. But you had a much more even distribution of wealth up there, and you had a bigger middle class, and that's where most of the invention came out of, in my own observation, is an example of, and throughout history, when you have more freedom, less war, and more secularism, that is when you see much more invention. And you can go back to Michelangelo and Da Vinci and all that. So, yeah, she grew up in Stalinist Russia, and so first of all, the other problem with Ayn Rand is from the time she got into America, she got all of her information from the New York Times. So when you get all your, and that's all she read that cover to cover every day. But when you get your source from only one source, when you get all your information from one source, that's always a problem. And so whatever you want to say about the New York Times, you need diverse sources of information. So the other problem. So again, she saw Stalinist Russia. She grew up in Stalinist Russia, and so America was a huge contrast to her. Well, the other problem with Ayn Rand and other people, other conservatives, is that they and liberals. You know, a lot of people. Statistics can be made to say anything. And so her sample rate, her sampling was only the New York Times. And also she stopped in the case of the robber barons, she stopped her history and Stalinist Russia. She stopped her history at the beginning of the Russian Revolution. Well, the beginning of the Russian Revolution, first of all, you know, what would have happened? The Russian Revolution, the reason Stalin came to power is because of U.S. industrialist support of fascists. This is a fact. I've talked to Russian studies students here at the U of O, and they agree with me that it was the U.S. support. It was U.S. industrialist support of fascists that brought fascist Russia to power. And think about it. What would have happened if Nicholas had agreed to the terms of the workers before the Russian Revolution? But he was pressured by aristocrats and industrialists not to negotiate with the workers. And so this is partly what brought on the Russian Revolution. So this is the point I'm saying with Ayn Rand, is that she's seeing, and then of course, I don't even want to get into that. We, you know, we have 20 million people they had gulags in Russia. We have 20 million people in a huge percentage of our largest percentage in the world of in prison here in the United States. And we had our own yes, we had giant skyscrapers and a lot of invention here, but it was on the backs of slaves and on the backs of stolen land. So she just leaves all that out of her philosophy, her theory. So and then just since I have time, I'll get into this more. I got other stuff that I'll bring up next week, but since I've remembered it, you know. One thing she's right and wrong about is that a committee, and this was the point of the Fountainhead, was, and I agree, as an artist, you don't want a committee to decide on art. But, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, all his roofs leaked. The Fountainhead was based on Frank Lloyd Wright, and all his roofs leaked. So, but I've experienced this. I've worked with consensus process since 1985, back in... when I was doing the Iran-Contra demonstrations. I wasn't doing them. I was just learning about demonstrations back in '85. And the consensus process, what it's meant to do is take a long time to make a decision so that you hear from all parties. And unfortunately, what happens is sometimes you need a leader to take the reins. And first of all, you either need to have an affinity for the project, or sometimes you just need someone, person, a manager, to take the reins. And, you know, the collectives in the Spanish Revolution, the Spanish Civil War, they voted in every year a new leader of the collectives and of the co-ops. So, but I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with the consensus process. You don't always need a leader. There's just sometimes you need someone to take the reins and go with what you're doing. So, and I'll give you, there's an example here in Oregon, and this is, I'm going to tie it into sustainability. There's a famous book of permaculture and sustainability called The Oregon Experiment. It's a trilogy called The Timeless Way of Building. This is a part of one of the trilogies is the Oregon Experiment. And right here in the U of O, in the U of O library, they have the actual report that the Oregon Experiment was based on. And what this report shows is that, and they do this to this day, when they design city projects and design them now, they get a bunch of input from the populace, which is as it should be. But then the designer comes in and says, look, we got to do this and go this direction because... people, and so what happened in the Oregon Experiment is people wanted flower pots on bus stops, and which would be is actually a great idea or whatever, but there were just so many weird crazy ideas that they had to narrow it down, and a designer would come in and who is trained in design and go, look, these aren't going to work, this is going to work, these are all great ideas, this idea isn't going to work. So that was an example of how you. A collective, you need a balance between, and one thing I want to say too is I don't follow any one philosophy. I try to take the best of all philosophies. So, you know, the Buddhist concept of balance and the yin and yang, Confucianism or wherever I got that from, balance of community involvement and someone taking the reins, sometimes that is the best way to go. Not saying that there's anything wrong with making all your decisions with a group using the consensus process. Just saying, it depends. So this is what I'm not saying I agree with Ayn Rand, but this is the point she was making about the individual. And in The Fountainhead, you can see how, you know, they take someone's idea and just throw a bunch of crap on it. And that I disagree with. And, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright did come up with some beautiful buildings and some beautiful ideas. But I'll just tell you, and then we'll get into Nathaniel Brandon because I want to have time to play you some King Crimson. I went to Taliesin, and he's got – and Taliesin, you know, this was known for years that you make a building face south. I mean, the Pueblo Indians used this method. But he made the building face east and west just so that the light would shine in – and make certain patterns in the house instead of facing it south and making it solar. So just that was just an observation, and I told him that when I was there at Taliesin. I criticized his, and they weren't down on me for that. They were just, I was a young man at that point. Okay, so let me get to Nathaniel Brandon, Ayn Rand's young lover. So give me a second to start up this tape. I got to go over here.
In 1991... the Library of Congress, in cooperation with the Book of the Month Club, launched a nationwide survey of which the purpose was to learn which books had had the most profound, life-changing impact on American readers. Number one predictably, was the Bible. Number two was Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. A year or two back, Random House did a national survey on the best and most important books of the 20th century. Readers nominated Atlas Shrugged as number one and Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead as number two. Neither of these events were highly publicized. That is another story. I met Ayn Rand a month before I turned 20. I was studying psychology at UCLA, and I learned that she was living in the Valley at that time, writing what I would later learn was Atlas Shrugged. I had first discovered The Fountainhead when I was pretty young, 14. I overheard my oldest sister with two of her girlfriends reading aloud to each other from the sex scenes. And when they left the book in the room after they left, with the contemptuous condescension possible only to a 14-year-old, I picked up the book to find out what all the excitement was about. And I very quickly found out that it was about an awful lot more than sex. By the time that I met Ayn Rand, 1950 March, I had reread The Fountainhead so many times that if you read any sentence to me, I could tell you the preceding thought and the succeeding thought. Now, what that meant practically was that I had internalized her way of thinking to an extraordinary degree and understood her way of thinking to an extraordinary degree. And that became a very important cementing bond, in spite of the fact that when we met, I wasn't yet 20, and she was 45. Our relationship lasted 18 years. And in the span of those 18 years, it went through many transformations, became many different kinds of things. In the beginning, it was the relationship of a young student to a mentor. Later, it became that of a friend, almost a family member. Later still, for several years, we turned into a relationship of a sexual affair. Later, or simultaneously, we were partners in various intellectual ventures, including the co-founding and co-publishing of two different publications. It ended in the summer of 1968, I guess the only word you would want to use to describe the relationship at that point would be adversarial. And the memoir is the story of those years, the story of the birth of the Objectivist movement, and of the people who created it. And it's also, for me, an opportunity to revisit my past from the perspective of many years later and with an awful lot more knowledge and compassion. And write what I thought would be an interesting piece of intellectual history. It was in 1982, lecturing in San Diego, that I first announced that I would feel the need one day to write a memoir. Because there was so much nonsense written about the Rand-Brandon relationship and the birth of Objectivism, so many false stories in circulation, that I felt an obligation and a desire to set the record straight. The problem was, I had zero interest in writing a memoir. I was deeply immersed in my work in the field of psychology, and during the 1980s, when was an especially rich decade for me of writing and publishing about five or six books during that decade. And a memoir was not really on my mind. It wasn't a high priority, even though I thought it could be interesting. What changed everything was one plane trip to New York with my wife, Devers, in which I began ruminating about my life and how work-oriented I'd always been. and how I hadn't given much time to what is loosely called play. And I began thinking about it and maybe feeling a bit sorry for myself. I don't know. But my wife, Deborah, looked at me and she began to laugh and she says, "Are you crazy?" She said, "You've been in love with drama all of your life. And anybody that knows the story knows that since the age of 18, you have been living nonstop theater. What do you think you missed? 2 weeks on the Riviera?" And it was one of those epiphanies, one of those great moments of a light bulb going on. And suddenly, I saw the whole story from the perspective of a dramatist or a novelist. I saw that it had a very logically designed plot structure, that all the key characters were logically, not accidentally, related. It had a climax, it had a denouement, and it certainly was high drama. And that's what finally ignited the desire to sit down and write the book. The original version, which was published in 1989, was called Judgment Day. When I had an opportunity to revise and edit the book for a new edition in 1999, it was a chance to go back, cut stuff I didn't need, and put in some very exciting, I think, interesting material which was omitted or never written for the first edition, with a new title, My Years with Ayn Rand. One reviewer did me the kindness of figuring out something that I had no idea of. He did a line-by-line comparison of the two memoirs and announced in his publication that there were 400 changes, 400 plus changes in the new edition. If you have read the book, or if you have an interest in reading the book, let me tell you one more thought about the concept of the book. Because the perspective of the book, of the story as drama, is absolutely essential to understanding how the book is written. I said to my wife and to my publisher, "I want to write a memoir in the form of a novel, in the form of a memoir." And that's the whole key to understanding the literary method of the book. In other words, I wanted to recreate scenes and take you in with me. For example, the first night that I met Ayn Rand at her home in Chatsworth and arrived at 8 o'clock at night and stayed talking philosophy till 5:30 in the morning, which set the pattern for our relationship almost to the end of the 18 years, of beginning at 8 o'clock and rarely ending our conversation before 5 in the morning. I wanted to let you know what it was like to be 20 and reading Atlas Shrugged as it was being written. I wanted to let you know what it was like to be at the Saturday nights when the original circle was being formed and was reading Atlas Shrugged as it was being written, sometimes hot off the press, literally when she finished writing that day. I guess the most famous member of our circle is a name known to all of you, and that's Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan. I wanted to let you understand how a totally strange relationship could become eroticized and could lead to a great deal of joy and ultimately to total catastrophe, because by the time it occurred, we had both, she had been married when we met and I had gotten married, neither of us too happily, and what took place with the knowledge and consent of our spouses. And how that could have happened is part of the book's story. But also, I wanted to say something about intellectual movements and how they can bring out the best in people and also the worst, and the strange things people can sometimes do in the name of misguided idealism. The book could have been called A Crisis of Self-Esteem, in alignment with the titles of so many of my other books. Because my self-esteem went on a roller coaster ride. And that's part of the struggle that I talk about in the book, to reclaim myself, to separate from a world which had nurtured me in many ways but had become in the end quite destructive. Now, when I give talks like these in bookstores, I'm inclined to want to keep my talks relatively brief, because my experience so far has been that there's usually a lot of questions, and I don't like to have people go home frustrated because there wasn't time to get their questions addressed. So I'm going to talk for a few more minutes, but then I'm going to invite questions, because that's often the most fun anyway. One of the most important things to understand about Einstein is the nature of her appeal to people. People in general, and young people in particular, and maybe the young person inside every person, irrespective of age. And that is a coherent frame of reference with which to understand the world, a very positive view of human potentialities, the sense of the possibility of having a sacred sense of mission about one's own life, and of course a code of values by which to guide one in confronting the challenges and decisions of life. Everybody knows that this is a writer whose books have touched the lives of millions of people, and yet there has never been a serious exploration of why. What is it all about? So that became one of my interests in writing the book, to attempt to address that question, to recreate for you what we got, what we all got out of it. And judging from the responses that I've got and the feedback that I've got, what's very interesting to me, since I felt when I was writing it that I was writing about a very unique kind of experience, which in a certain sense it obviously was, and yet I was astonished again and again and again by the times I met people or heard people via mail or email that they found themselves in bits all over the book and could relate to things in their own life in ways I never would have dreamed of when I was writing the book. Another way of talking about what the book is about, more narrowly personal to me, would be to say that it's the story of my development told through my relationships to three women, of which the character that integrates the whole story and is the centerpiece of the drama is, of course, Ayn Rand and my relationship with her. There was the first girl that I married, and to whom I was introduced because she was a passionate admirer of Ayn Rand as I was. There was Ayn Rand herself. There was years later, when my marriage had fallen apart and my relationship with Rand was in very bad trouble, a student in my lecture course in New York that I fell in love with, and following the break, married. And then there was the tragedy of her death in an accident 9 years later. And in the epilogue, the struggle to begin life all over again, 22 years ago. So, the book is a love story. It's a multiple love story. And what I thought would be interesting for people, and I hope will be interesting for you, is the fact that very few men, more women have, but very few men, have chosen to write personally and intimately about what the experience of love is like from the inside. Most books that have been written that address that were written by women. And I thought it would be interesting to have a man talk about that in a, I think, quite candid and self-disclosing way, I had a good friend in Washington, D.C. who was an admirer of my work, but mad at me for writing this memoir. And I said, why? He said, you shouldn't have written it. And I said, why? He says, you took off your Batman suit. I said, but that's part of what I wanted to teach. I want to be perceived without my Batman suit. That's part of what I teach as a therapist. So I hope that's meaningful. I thank you for your attention. I told you I would keep my formal remarks brief. I hope you found them of some interest. And I hope that you'll have lots of questions for me. And there's almost no, as far as I'm concerned, unaskable questions. Thank you very much.
What would you say is the largest change in the new version?
Oh, the largest change in the new version compared to the original?
Right.
Number one, I can't say which is the largest. I'll name three different issues. One, the cutting of material that was extraneous, that didn't deal with the central characters, and that I became convinced was not that important, and I wanted to create space for the addition of new material. Two, correcting some unintentional factual errors, but dates or sequences, and realizing that in certain passages I'd implied certain things which I hadn't meant to imply, and gave a certain wrong impression, at least for some people, and a chance to clean that up. More importantly, perhaps, the chance to make the reader have a more sympathetic understanding of the context of people with whom I was in an adversarial relationship. In other words, I tried to be more balanced and benevolent toward people with whom I was very much at odds at the time. But perhaps the most exciting and marvelous addition. So there's a lot of explanations that weren't in the original. But the thing that, for me, was the greatest thrill to include, it was written for the original book and eliminated in the final editing for unimportant reasons. And that was that years after my break with Rand, years after my second wife, Patricia, had died, my wife, Debris, had a series of secret, not secret from me, but secret from the world, meetings / conversations with Ayn Rand. And that, for me, is more theatrical than anything in the original book. And so when I had a chance to bring out a new edition, I thought, God, I have to reinstall that in the credit this story. Yes?
I just had a question. In the book, you say that Dominique, in a sense, is the most difficult character to understand in certain ways. And I was wondering how Ayn Rand saw Dominique in any relationship to Dagny later on, and whether that
Sure. was... Sure. You asked about the character of Dominique, and I said in the book that I found her a very difficult character to make psychological sense out of. But I know that I know how Rand saw her and how she accounted for it. I mean, her joke was, she'd say, well, Dominique is myself in a bad mood. But that's not really a psychological explanation. She saw her, I'm using her language because this is the way she would express it, as kind of a priestess relative to the ideal man, for whom ordinary reality was absolutely intolerable. Conventional reality was absolutely intolerable. And she couldn't find any way to live her own values in this world. And out of her terror that the man she was in love with was going to be destroyed by the world, she went through a period of, in effect, running amok. And Ian said to me in contemplative moments, you know, if you take this literally, Dominique really was quite stupid. She's sort of a literary character, but she never did produce what I would call a serious or in-depth psychological explanation for her. You kind of have to take it as an abstraction, as an allegory, as an archetype of a certain type of personality. But it doesn't bear
in-depth thinking about psychologically, because you'd have to be forced to the conclusion a person who would behave this way is seriously disturbed. Yes, sir. Thank you for the question. Go ahead.
I was wondering if you had any comments on this movie that was done on the Passion of Ayn Rand.
For that question, I better take my jacket off. I'm asked if I have any comment on the... Yeah, my first wife, Barbara, wrote a biography of Ayn Rand called The Passion of Ayn Rand, and Showtime did a film adaptation. Barbara didn't write the script. She merely wrote the original book. And I didn't know any of the people in that teleplay, meaning there was not a single sentence that any of the characters said to one another that any one of us would have said. I thought that the performance of Helen Mirren in particular was superb. I thought Peter Fonda was very good. It's very difficult for most American writers, and most writers, I suppose, what we have to say, but I will have to say for American writers, to write entertaining dialogue of intellectuals, to capture how intellectuals talk, but make it natural and entertaining and interesting, so that what happens is when you try, what you often get is something very stilted. And whenever the teleplay attempted to deal with ideas, it became embarrassing. I was laughing. I saw it several times, but the first time I saw it, I spent a great deal of time either laughing or groaning. Of course, on a more personal level, I was offended because it never used the real woman I fell in love with and gave me a totally fictitious romance with somebody who, in every respect I can think of, was the diametrical opposite of the woman that I fell in love with, who was ultimately precipitated the collapse of the whole movement. On top of that, they made it a patient of mine in therapy, which is really quite libelous. I asked my lawyer about it, and he says, all you'll do is get more people aware of it. If you're a public figure, you're very much, you have almost no defense in these they can write anything, put anything in your mouth. If you're even a half public figure, I think of myself as half. So the bottom line is, it wouldn't tell anybody anything about Ayn Rand or Nathaniel Brandon or the world intellectually they inhabited. Yeah, thank you.
I have not read her books. I only saw one documentary about her, but I am familiar a little bit with your work. When you two were dating, this was in the 50s, which was a very conservative period, and she was already in her 40s and you were in your 20s.
Yes.
So how was that relationship? Because even nowadays, when people are more open, a relationship between a 20-year-old male and a 45-year-old woman is not that
moment,
so...
did you hear the question? Okay. You can't really talk about the 50s or the 60s when you were talking about us. I mean, we simply didn't play by those rules. But here's what you have to understand. From my perspective, here was somebody that had been my mentor, my teacher, I'd idolized since the age of 14. When I met her, we felt like we were soulmates. You have to understand that. I felt better understood by her than by anybody. I felt more appreciated by her than by anybody. She helped me to see myself and understand myself far beyond anything that had ever happened before. And interestingly enough, she would have said the same thing about me. She would have said that this man understands me like no one else on the planet. Now, two alienated people, neither in an especially fulfilling marriage. It's where there's a tremendous mutual admiration. Given the right set of circumstances, that can become sexualized. And you can misunderstand what is happening. And I certainly did. But It sounds funny now, but there was never any question of doing anything in secret from our spouses. That would have been unthinkable. So they were immediately, as soon as we became aware of our feelings, it became a four-way conversation. Yes, in the blue shirt, I'll get you. I'll do my best not to disappoint anybody if I humanly can unless they throw us out. Go ahead.
It's kind of an in-depth question. I don't mean to, like, bring the mood very, I don't want to say serious, but higher order thinking.
I thought it already was serious, but go ahead.
After reading Atlas Shrugged when I was younger, okay, like, exhilarating experience, obviously, philosophically, except I had thought of and never really been introduced to in a more perfect form. I kind of bought into it real quick, more quick than I should have, without thinking, adopted stuff that I didn't actually think and followed, you know, other people's thoughts. And as a result, I underwent a great deal of emotional repression, which I hear is common a lot of times.
Oh, yeah. And I write about that.
Do you have any insights into why that causes emotional repression?
Oh, yeah. I discuss that in the book. Did you hear the gentleman's question?
No.
The gentleman said that he read the book when he was young and became kind of uncritically very enthusiastic about it, perhaps too quickly. And one of the byproducts of him doing so, if I understood him, was that he became quite emotionally repressed. And he wants to know, why do I think that would happen? And the reason why it would happen is that in both the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, there are passages, even though this was not Rand's conscious intention, which encourage emotional repression. There is, for example, if you look up in the Fountainhead, the beginning of part two, when Rourke is working in the granite quarry, and there's a scene where he's sitting on a hill and he's contemplating his own suffering. And he sees it as like some enemy that he has to kill in himself. So that repression is presented there as something heroic. Later in Atlas Shrugged, there are many examples, both of Reardon and Dagny, where they are dealing with suffering in a way that clearly implies repression. And this is presented as very noble. And in contrast to that, whenever she wants to characterize the villains, they're already up to their eyebrows swimming in unexamined feelings and emotions. So you don't have to be a genius to get the point. Now, what's very interesting is that an opposite message is also communicated in Atlas Shrugged. Example. Francisco, one of the things Francisco is most eager to communicate to Reardon is to not to be so quick about ignoring his own emotions. He should take them more seriously, and he should listen to them and not be so quick to sacrifice them. So, really, there are two conflicting messages. But, in much the same way that psychologists teach parents, their children will remember what you did long after they remember what you said. What she said about the relationship of reason and emotion is less important than what the characters that one is led to admire are shown doing. So that because of what my connections were, an awful lot of admirers of her work passed through my consulting room. So I got a lot of chances to look at the whole phenomenon of emotional repression as it relates to her work. And as I say, I write about that in the book. Okay, this is a green shirt. Okay? Green shirt. Use my dust from the light here. Squeeze me to her breast, sewed me with carbon, strung my warp across time. Gave me each shore, sunrise and graveyard, told me only I was her. Bid me face the east, close me in questions, built the sky from my dawn. Washed me down a slide too.
got phosphate on stale chalk, ate the floors of their cages. Strong little lost their hair, paybox collapsed, and lion sharpened their teeth.
KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kpw.org. All right, this has been Talk is Cheap. You've been listening to Nathaniel Brandon, Ayn Rand's Young Lover, and you'll get part two next week and some more criticism of Ayn Rand and why conservatives have totally misinterpreted her and she was wrong anyway. And a little bit on Discipline Global Mobile. You know, check out your favorite band's website, because now you can buy stuff directly from the band and cut out the corporate record companies. So that's what Discipline Global Mobile is. It's too complicated to even understand, you know, let alone explain how Discipline Global Mobile works, but it ultimately gets money to the musician. And instead of the giant record corporations that don't even release stuff from popular musicians if it won't make them money. So here's another cut from that. Support independent media.
Oregon on November 19th from 2 to 8 p.m., the Trauma Healing Project will be hosting a webathon, Trauma Healing, This Is Our Time, a free community building event providing an